This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
I called up an activist in Minneapolis named Tony Williams. He's been out in the streets protesting nearly every day since the killing of George Floyd.
We had a thunderstorm here, and it had been so humid for the week before that. People just like sweating through COVID masks, right? And I think last night, finally, things started to slow down a little bit.
Tony Williams is involved in an effort called NPD 150, a coalition of activists, researchers, and artists that came together in 2016 to do a review of the Minneapolis Police Department over the past 150 years. Ultimately, they proposed to gradually reduce the policing budget and instead allocate the funds to social workers and community-led organizations. That approach of quote-unquote defunding the police has now become a rallying cry at protests across the country. Minneapolis has seen a number of police-involved killings of black men before George Floyd, which seems like a stark contrast to the city's liberal reputation. Last year, Minneapolis was rated as one of the top 10 cities to live in, according to U.S. News rankings. I brought this up with Tony Williams.
Minneapolis is definitely one of the top 10 places to live for white people and for people with economic and cultural privilege, right? We're a state and a city with some of the worst racial disparities in the entire country, right? When you look at our home ownership rates for black folks, when you look at income disparities, when you look at the opportunity gap in the schools, there's an immense discrepancy between the opportunities that are afforded to white residents of the city and the opportunities that are afforded to everyone else. And that is like built into the like geography of the city. I mean, we had the same housing covenants and redlining systems that were present all over the United States. And it's resulted in very specific enclaves of particularly the African-American community. Most folks live on the north side. And that's a community that was sort of riven in two by the construction of Interstate 94 back in the 50s. And so that means that it's quite literally separated from the rest of the city. And my parents even, my dad in particular, had deep connections to the vestiges of that community. And I've grown up with an immense amount of privilege personally, right? I'm a very light-skinned black man. I'm biracial, and I have had a lot of economic opportunity that a lot of our brothers and sisters have not had access to. So I'm the exception in many ways to the rule of how black folks are treated in Minneapolis, and I'm constantly aware of that when I move through our city.
During the Great Migration, when there are lots of African Americans coming from the South to cities in the North and the Midwest, and in a lot of ways that sets the template for how policing functions in these communities to this day. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the MPD 150 report, the performance review for the Minneapolis Police Department on its 150th anniversary.
Absolutely. Well, and I think the historical context that you just mentioned is so important to understanding the context of the department. And that's why we wrote the report. And again, it wasn't just me. It was a huge collection of community members who came together to collaboratively produce this report. So the reason why the MPD 150 report came to be is because there were conversations happening around that history in the wake of the murders of Jamar Clark and Philando Castile. And it was 2016, and people had said, it's clear at this point that this is a cycle and that we keep seeing these killings, but that we don't even really know the history of the police department or of racialized violence within the police department here. And how can we tell that story fully without understanding the context we're operating in? And how do we know where to go from here? How can we find our way out of this cycle? We sectioned it into three parts. The first section of the report is the past section. And we had, again, dozens of community members putting in hundreds, maybe thousands of hours of primary source research into looking at the history of the department and also the failed reform attempts. And then the present section of the report, we interviewed dozens of community members across Minneapolis, especially Black community members. But in addition to that, community members who are involved in social services work about what they see community safety as and the intersections that do and don't exist with their work with police work and how they find the police department to work with. The final section of the report lays out a trajectory towards a police-free future and basically says that from our analysis, it's going to be impossible for us to reform the police department. Everything that is rolled out in response to issues of brutality has been ineffective and or like immediately opposed by the police union and rolled back. And the fact of the matter is there are too many structural obstacles to shifting a 19th century paramilitary force designed to keep Black and Native folks in check into an instrument of effective 21st century safety. And so we lay out sort of what that means and what that looks like. We talk about all of the different functions that police fulfill. And then we talk about how those functions are already being met by alternative safety strategies in Minneapolis and what future implementation of those strategies in lieu of the police might look like.
So what does a police-free future look like for Minneapolis? And what are some of the alternatives to conventional policing that are happening right now?
Yeah, I mean, when I think about a police-free Minneapolis, I actually have seen it in the last couple days, right? Minneapolis police and the National Guard here have been mostly focused on criminalizing, brutalizing, and arresting protesters the last few days rather than keeping our community safe. And if you think about, for example, like a lot of suburban white communities, they barely have contacts with police, right? And for the most part, like their needs are met in other ways, right? And so I think that's a good example of what some things could look like. And then from like a crisis management and safety response perspective, again, we can have mental health professionals respond to mental health calls. We can have victim survivor advocates respond to domestic violence and sexual assault calls. And if and when people need to be deployed whose job is to be prepared for violence, they don't have to be people who are unaccountable to our community, who are from outside our community, and who have a deep systemic culture that shoots first and asks questions later.
Let me ask you something on the other side of that. When I've gone into communities, like communities that have systemically been plagued with problems about police violence, and, you know, reporting from Ferguson, reporting from Newark, reporting from Baltimore, I have to tell you, when I talk to people in these communities who are at the brunt of police violence, they tend to also bear the brunt of community violence. And one of the things that was probably ironic, or maybe not, is that you are as likely to get concerns from them that there aren't enough police in their communities. And so it kind of doesn't connect to that. So I wonder if, like, is this something that there's a broad groundswell for? Are people in the community saying this, or is there a kind of more complicated scenario here?
Yeah, here in Minneapolis, I mean, it's different right now, right? I mean, the last 5 years we've seen demands for reform mostly at every protest. And now we're seeing demands for abolition and defunding at every protest. And the conversations about officer diversity and de-escalation training are largely gone here in Minneapolis on the ground. And we're seeing city council members come out and actually say that they want to fundamentally restructure the department and or disband it, right, and create something different. Well, I think when people are demanding more of a police presence, what they're really demanding is more safety. And we know that crime isn't caused by bad actors. The vast majority of the time, it's caused by poverty. It's caused by disinvestment. And there are alternatives to this. Again, we spent millennia as a species finding ways to care for each other in community outside of policing. And we don't know exactly what that looks like in the 21st century. But I do deeply believe it's possible and that we're on our way there.
Well, I think that that report has pointed to the really kind of disturbing elements of the history that is common to a lot of police departments, and the way in which we are rooted in that history, particularly as we've seen the events taking place over the past 2 weeks. So, Tony, thank you very much for your time. Thank you for the work you're doing, and look forward to hearing more from you.
Thank you, Jelani. It was relaxing and productive to be having this conversation instead of running around trying to put out fires on the ground here in Minneapolis. So I appreciate your time.
I would imagine.
Staff writer Jelani Cobb talked last week with Tony Williams, a member of the Minneapolis group MPD 150. We need to clarify that no charges were brought against the officers who killed Jamar Clark, and the officer involved in the killing of Philando Castile was acquitted.